Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Friday night here on Suspense Radio. I tell you, I love that song. It just gets me going. But here we go. Sorry, I want to say apology for sorry here. This is your host, John Robb. Tuesday night, we had something we couldn't do the show, but we are going to bring back Steve Barry and Jeremy Robinson. So check out for that. But tonight, we have John Miller, who's going to be on first, talking about his book, The First Assassin, historical thriller set in Civil War time with Abraham Lincoln. And coming back here also is going to be Alan Jacobson. He's going to be talking about his book tour, BoucherCon, and so much other stuff that we got going on because, you know, we had so many things we got into with him and we just couldn't do it. So, everybody, 60 Minutes of Suspense Radio starts right now. Everybody for a great Friday night here on Suspense Radio. 2 days before Halloween, one of the biggest holidays that, of course, you know, suspense thriller horror writers have. This is where the thrills and the chills all come to life. You feel that cold breath on the back of your neck. You look around, no one's there. And so you start to get worried. Or is it just the book you're reading? You just never know. So I want to say that we put something out on Facebook and we had the masses come and email me. I don't know how many stories I got. I was so impressed. I loved all of them. I wish I could do all of them, but I did decide, yes, I think it is time. We are going to have our first annual Suspense Magazine Halloween show here on Sunday, October 31st. Now, there's going to be no interviews. It's going to be stories that I'm going to read live on the air. I'm going to have it fully produced. I'm working on everything to get it all down pat. So it's something that you're just going to have to sit back, relax, and listen to. You can listen to over and over because I'm going to record it early on Sunday morning, and it's just going to be able to just play throughout the day so you can hear it whenever you would like to. And, of course, you can always go back. I will announce on Facebook only the stories that I'm going to read. Like I said, I could probably read them all, but I can only stay on the air for so long because you can only hear my voice for so long before I, you know, I just get, you know, kind of hoarse and it just doesn't sound any good anymore. Then I just sound really weird. So I'm going to pick a couple stories that I'm going to read on the air. First annual Halloween special. I think it's going to be great. Hopefully it's something that's very exciting because I'm thinking about changing the radio show up a little bit where maybe 1 week we're going to do some interviews, maybe the next week we maybe read a story here and there and make things a little different. So I don't know. We're going to see how well this does and you know how well everything comes together and maybe that's what we end up deciding to do here in the future just to change up Suspense Radio and make more authors along with their short stories you know, come to life instead of having to read them. You'll be able to hear them, hopefully, in full production, if I don't screw it up. So that's the big thing. Hopefully I won't screw it up. So again, that's this Sunday coming up here on Halloween. I'm going to tape it about 8:30 in the morning. So it will be available on the East Coast very early. You're talking at about 11:30, sometime after 12:30 in the afternoon. You'll be able to listen to it all day long, whatever you'd like to do. Like I said, Steve Barry and Jeremy Robinson, I'm so sorry that I missed that show on Tuesday and I couldn't do it, but they are going to be back. I have Steve Barry coming back on November the 23rd. I'm going to see when I can get Jeremy Robinson back on. We're still online here. I'm going to nail down John Saul for his November date, along with Clive Cussler. We do have Patricia Cornwell coming on November the 30th. I'm going to have Andrew Clavin and Homer Hickman coming up later this month. So we're going to fix the website. We're going to have it all out there. I'm going to fix it here on the show, and you'll be able to list everything that's going on. Just not quite sure exactly how everything's going to fit in exactly on the show and how it's going to work. Still trying to work out some of the kinks on what I'm going to do. But enough with all of that said. Hopefully everyone has gone out and bought Suspense Magazine on the shelves. We are kicking it right now, and it was great, especially with, you know, how many orders that we got in. You can always go to our website and order it for yourself if you'd like to. Now, our first author here, written numerous books, writes for the National Review, writes for the Wall Street Journal, and he goes and he decides, you know what, in an interview that he wrote, you know, I never really ask what's inspired you to write, because I think he gets asked that 17,000 times, and he has all those listed here. If you go to his book on Amazon.com and you go to The First Assassin under John J. Miller, you're able to see an interview that he has, a Q&A. So we're not just going to rehash the same things of why he decided to write this book, but we are going to go ahead and we're going to talk about, you know, the book and what it's about. And I want to, you know, welcome John Miller to the show right now. So, John, how are you doing? And thank you so much.
I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, no problem. It's an honor for us to have you on. Like I said, you know, you've written for the National Review, or you write for the National Review, the Wall Street Journal, and a bunch of other publications. And this is your first stab here, I guess, at a fiction thriller. Is that correct?
That's right. This is my first novel.
And, you know, stab was pun intended, even though I said shot, maybe, because that was what kind of your book is. And it's called The First Assassin. It's a historical thriller, Abraham Lincoln time. So can you kind of, you know, tell everybody a little bit about the book, and, you know, that would be great.
It takes place in Washington, D.C., primarily, 1861, at the very start of the Civil War. President Lincoln is inaugurated, Fort Sumter falls, and there is an assassin on the loose in Washington, D.C., trying to murder him.
And so for people, because, you know, people might have picked up the book and said, oh, this is going to maybe be about John Wilkes Booth and how he does stuff. Do you want to kind of make it maybe clear that this is definitely a fiction book about an assassination on President Lincoln, but not the actual one, correct?
Correct. This is a historical thriller. It is a work of fiction. It is a piece of my imagination. It takes place at the start of the Civil War rather than at the end of the Civil War. So 4 years, almost exactly 4 years before John Wilkes Booth fired his gun in Ford's Theater. I tried to make it historically authentic, though. I tried to bring Washington, D.C. of 1861 to life. I tried to have a lot of period details and make the city as real as possible, as authentic as possible, to serve as a kind of architecture for the fictional story that I tell.
Yeah, and I find that extremely fascinating, because you're basically taking, you know, a real life, almost a real life event, because it's not the actual assassination of President Lincoln, but it's basically someone trying to assassinate him 4 years before it actually happened. And I find that fascinating because, you know, not a lot of authors would tackle a subject like that. They might just try to put their spin on, you know, John Wilkes Booth going after Lincoln and maybe making it a fictional story that way, or what they consider to maybe be true. Do you, you know, that your intent was definitely not to do anything at all like that, wasn't? Am I right?
Oh, I didn't want to go anywhere near John Wilkes Booth. Certainly not for this book.
Right.
I'm fascinated by this particular period in Civil War history. I'm a Civil War buff, going back to when I was a kid. I used to stare at books with illustrations of battlefields and so on. and mm-hmm. eventually started looking at the words and reading the words and appreciating the actual history a little bit. The early months of the Civil War are fascinating because here you have President Lincoln coming to Washington, D.C. You know, most Americans hadn't voted for him. People were skeptical of him. Who was this prairie lawyer from way out west? They didn't know who he was or what he'd be able to do. Totally untested. The southern states are seceding. He comes to Washington. There are these rumors all over about assassination conspiracies, about bomb plots in the U.S. Capitol, about people trying to kidnap him and taking him south and holding him ransom, about rumors of a militia in Virginia organizing and marching across the Potomac River and seizing the Capitol. All this stuff was going on. People didn't know what to believe. They didn't know what was going to happen next. It was a harrowing moment in American history. They start firing at Fort Sumter. They just didn't know what was going to happen next. And a lot of people were concerned about President Lincoln's safety. It turns out that they were right to be worried about it. We know
right.
years later that you know, there was no Secret Service at the time, and people just did not take presidential security seriously enough in that age. But that's what it was like then. It was a time when you could knock on the door of the White House, ask to see the president, and actually expect to get a meeting. And this is the kind of environment in which Lincoln walks into. And so I had the idea, well, what if actually somebody did try to kill the president? What if somebody hired a professional hitman to go to Washington and do the deed? What would happen? And the first assassin imagines that story.
Yeah, and that's what I think is great, because you do bring in the great piece of, you know, Abraham Lincoln is probably one of the most beloved presidents, you know, that the United States have ever had. When everybody, you know, even like from Obama to whatever, they always say Abraham Lincoln is one of the greatest presidents ever, and they have it for different, you know, reasons of why. And he was the first president assassinated. Am I right? I don't know if I'm right or not on that one.
He was the first president assassinated. He was not the first president who was the target of assassination. That was Andrew Jackson, a lunatic, a sort of John Hinckley, a madman type figure tried to kill Jackson, but Lincoln was the first who was actually killed.
Okay, and that was before Jodie Foster was born, so couldn't blame that one.
Exactly.
Okay, that's good. So you come out and it's got to be a lot of research to go ahead and go back into 1861, and I know that there's tons of, I think the Civil War has been written about more than, you know, the war that I like to go back and look at, and that's the American Revolution. I always found that fascinating more than the Civil War. So you did have a lot of things to go to and a lot of research objects, you know, in order to bring your book in here. But for you, and this is relaying to my question that one of your fans wrote over to us, you know, where does the history end and where does the fiction begin in your story, and how do you know where to separate the two?
Well, that's a great question. The book did require a lot of research. They say the past is a foreign country, and when you go and try to understand the America of 1861, there are just all kinds of things we don't know about it that living in you know, in the 21st century, we can barely imagine. And so I wanted to go back and learn things like, you know, what was Pennsylvania Avenue like in 1861? Where was the seedy part of Washington, D.C.? You know, where was the dangerous part with the saloons and brothels and so forth, the crime-ridden part of Washington, D.C.? There are answers to these questions.
Mm-hmm.
You need to go research them and find them out. So what I tried to do with this book is understand Washington as much as I could. And as you say, the source material is extremely rich. There's a lot of great books and documents out there to learn this stuff, but you do have to go learn it. And so I tried to learn about Washington of that period as much as I could and bring it alive in the book. The real Washington then becomes kind of a skeleton around which I can shape my fiction. And I'm dealing with real historical people. You know, Abraham Lincoln was obviously a real guy. General Winfield Scott, another real person who's in the book. There are several characters like that, real people from history who walk on stage. The main characters in my book, however, are fictional. A couple of them are based upon real people. And here's where we get to your question: how do you draw the line between real history and your imagination? The main character of my book is a guy named Colonel Charles Rook. He's an Army colonel. He's a Union man, but he's not a Lincoln man. He didn't vote for Lincoln in the presidential election, yet he is charged with protecting the president. He is in charge of presidential security, whatever, you know, it didn't mean much at the time, but he was in charge of whatever that meant back in that day. He's based on a guy who was actually in charge of presidential security, who was in charge of the D.C. militias, an Army colonel. And when I first started writing the book, I was actually using the real historical figure's name in the book. I figured, well, I'll just, you know, adapt his story. As I was telling the tale, though, as I was writing the novel, I started taking more liberties with what I knew to be the facts of this particular person's life. And there came a point where I said to myself, you know, I'm doing too much here. So instead of changing the story, I changed the character's name. And I fictionalized him more fully. So there are judgment calls to be made, but what I try and do is, when I'm talking about real historical people and historical places in the book, I'm trying to be as accurate as possible. And then when there are fictional characters, I'm trying to make them accurate in their way and in terms of true to their time, but we know they're not real.
And, you know, when you went back and you said it was a time when you could literally go up to the White House, knock on the door, say, hey, I'm a Girl Scout selling cookies, and the president says, hey, I'll buy some cookies, you know, and it was kind of, you know, a lot more open. Did you find it, you know, more difficult in order to say, well, what if a guy just walks in, and then just, boom, just shoots? Because, it, you know, it could almost be that easy. Did you find it when you were writing the story that you did have to incorporate, you know, something that probably wasn't there in order to make the thrill set for the book, you know, much more edge of your seat for the reader?
Well, it's funny you mention that, and I don't want to give away too much of the story, but there's
a... Don't worry, it's just you and me. You go right ahead.
there's a scene in the book that deals with that question precisely, and I don't want to say more, though. But you know... This is how it was. You could literally knock on the door and ask to see the president. One of the president's main jobs back in those days was filling patronage positions in the federal government. We don't do that anymore.
Oh.
We have civil service rules. You know, all that was done away with several decades after Lincoln. But when Lincoln was president, one of his main jobs was just, you know, appointing the postmaster of Marshall, Michigan, for crying out loud.
Right.
And making these decisions and people trying to use their influence to determine who gets these jobs. Lincoln would meet with people who were seeking jobs, people who wanted certain people in jobs. They were seeing him constantly. And one of the problems with actually trying to get at the president, if you did mean him harm, is that he was actually surrounded by people all the time. I mean, people were waiting in line outside his office. So you could maybe try and do something, but there'd be lots of witnesses, lots of people ready to jump in and grab you. In certain ways, it was, you know, he did not have a security detail the way presidents do now, but it's not that he was completely naked to people who would seek to do him harm.
Yeah, and the funny thing when you're talking about what Lincoln did, because it was actually Ulysses S. Grant when he screwed it up so bad that they decided that civil servants had to take a test because he was appointing people, President Grant, who were so inept for the job, he was just giving his friends all these positions and the whole country started going to hell in a handbasket. So I remember that in history, that it was his administration that really forced the government to say, okay, these people got to start taking a test to see if they can even hold down a job like this.
Yeah, so it was in the 1880s, yeah. Then 1890s.
Right.
There was a transitional period, but we do it completely differently now. There are still obviously
right.
appointments the president makes, but it's nothing like what it used to be.
Right. So basically, you really have kind of written, with the first assassin, you've almost written the first, I guess you want to say, kind of infiltration double agent kind of spy within the government, but not from another country, from this country, where a lot of the thrillers are maybe some kind of infiltrating person from another country coming over here now to do harm, you know, to our president or government or some kind of thing in the country. You kind of wrote it as the first one to say, this is infiltration from within. This is a domestic terrorist kind of thing to come after the president.
Well, it's a domestic conspiracy. The assassin who's hired to go after Lincoln is a mysterious figure in the book. His backstory is not revealed until towards the end, and there is a bit of an international angle to it, but. A little bit in Baltimore and South Carolina as well.
Yeah. And so I thought that, you know, I think that that was great, was, you know, just doing it, you know, that way by having that kind of, you know, angle kind of in there. I mean, that was just, you know, I think it's great. And I also think it's great that what's the word I'm looking for is that you do make the actual – you know, the actual killer more mysterious, so it's kind of more of a mystery thriller until, you know, the revealing starts to coming at the end, and that's what makes the reader just, you know, continue to, you know, grab on, because you're not like following, because you know a lot of thrillers, you might know who the person is, the killer, and then you know who the guy is following them, and then their paths meet. But yours was a little different in that fact.
My hope with this book is that first and foremost, it tells a great story, that it's a piece of entertainment, and people will enjoy it at that level. I also, secondly, want to have a bit of history in here. I don't want it to be pedantic. I don't want it to be, you know, feel like a textbook, and I hope it never does, but there are lots of great little details about Washington, D.C. The Capitol Dome was not complete during this period. The Washington Monument was not complete. And there are scenes where these little bits and pieces of history wind up playing a part in the book. But first and foremost comes the story, and I hope it's a great thriller set in this really compelling period of American history.
And I want to remind everybody that we're talking here with John J. Miller, author of The First Assassin. And your official website is heymiller.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's heymiller.com, heymiller.com.
And, you know, you have a lot of things, because you've written some nonfiction books, too, that are out there. But your, you know, The First Assassin is on here very prominent because it just came out. And so what do you have in store for the future with your fiction writing? What are you going to be tackling next?
Well, as you say, I'm a professional writer of nonfiction, and I've written a number of books of nonfiction. I'll continue doing that. I would like to write a sequel to The First Assassin. In fact, I've started working on one. I've got a concept for it. Although The First Assassin is a complete story in and of itself, when you get to the end, you see where the door is left open for some continuing adventures. And the idea I have will take a number of the main characters from The First Assassin and carry them into the war. So The First Assassin, the story concludes before, you know, the first battle at Bull Run or Manassas.
Right.
But I've got an idea that'll take the characters into the conventional fighting that is about to erupt.
So it's going to be more along the lines, you think, of the actual Civil War and the Union Confederate with something going on, or is it going to still be, you know, a little bit on the different side where it's going to be more of the thrill chase happening?
Well, we'll see. You know, I'm only just getting going with it. It'll have more conventional military aspects to it, just because that's what the Civil War became. But it'll have also a lot of intrigue, perhaps an international intrigue, and we'll see.
Okay. And that's something that, you know, you've been thinking about. So when you wrote The First Assassin, did you know that you wanted to do a sequel?
No. The First Assassin took me years and years to write. It was the project that I kept setting aside when deadlines loomed and children were born, and it was the labor of love that I was always struggling to find time for, but it was also the thing I set aside when I needed to find time for other things. It took years and years to do, and I was just glad to be done when I finally finished it, and you know, just across the finish line, you know, it's like the marathon runner. I mean, the last thing you want to ask that guy is, are you going to do this again tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
But look, the truth is, I did really enjoy writing it, and I'm happy with the result, especially now that I've gained a little bit of perspective, and I've heard from readers who have enjoyed it, and that's one of the most gratifying experiences, by the way, is when you get an email from someone you've never met before who says I really like the book. That just makes my day when I get that kind of thing. I would like to try it again. And so I'm gonna be turning to that soon.
And I'm sure now your publisher's like, well, John, it can't take you 5 years to write this one. You got to have it done in a certain amount of time.
Yeah, I'm gonna look. The First Assassin took a long time, and I don't intend to have that happen again. I do think, you know, I learned a lot when I was writing The First Assassin. Writing a novel is the hardest thing I've ever written. As a professional writer, this is the hardest piece of writing I've ever done. I learned a lot while, you know, you learn it while you do it, and I learned a lot while I was writing. I think I can do it more quickly next time. I've also just had such a great experience with this first one. The gratification of seeing it in print, and the satisfaction of that I think that'll give me the right kind of motivation to know that I'll write it, it'll see print, and hopefully sell a few copies.
Yeah, and you know that right now is, you know, how well is the book doing? Have you heard, you know, things that are going on as far as your sales and stuff like that, because you got some great reviews. I mean, when you get Vince Flynn and you get Brad Thor, you know, on top talking about it, and Andrew Clavin, who we're having on the radio show. I mean, you got some great, you know, heavy hitters that you got to read your book. You know, first of all, how did you get them to read it? Because I know that it's not easy to have that happen.
Well, you know, I'm so grateful to these guys for having given me outstanding blurbs that are on this book. Vince Flynn says, an excellent book. It's like The Day of the Jackal set in 1861 Washington. And, you know, that's exactly how I was thinking about the book when I wrote it. I was thinking to myself, this is Day of the Jackal at the start of the Civil War. And so to have him say that, it meant a lot to me. I host an author interview podcast program for National Review Online. Once a week, I interview an author. We do fiction. We do nonfiction. It's called Between the Covers. You can go on nationalreview.com and find it. Mm-hmm. We do this once a week. I've been doing it for a number of years now, and I've done it several times with Vince Flynn, with Brad Thor, with Andrew Clavin. And, you know, when I had my manuscript done, I'm thinking to myself, I could really stand some blurbs. So I sent these really sheepish emails to these guys whose works I've admired. And I said, look, feel free to say no, but you know, because you must get this all the time, but I've written this novel, and if you have it in your heart, would you look at it and let me know what you think? And they all said, sure. They asked to see it. And then, you know, they took several weeks or a month or two in a couple of cases and got back to me and said, we like it, here's a blurb. And so I was able to get these fantastic blurbs for the book. They were very generous, and I'm grateful to them, and they certainly didn't have to do it, and I gave them every you know, I look back at these emails I sent when I was like, you know, I was trying to make it as easy for them to say no, as easy as possible for them to say no. But, you know, there is a fraternity of writers out there. And guys like that are interested in helping guys like me and giving us a boost, and they were, as I say, they're great people in my mind for, yeah, for
and as you know, Vince Flynn started out by having to self-publish his first book, so you know I know that he definitely knows what it's like, you know, starting up,
and it's, you know, and he's not forgotten, and he doesn't, you know, he's just a, you know, these are great guys.
Right, he is, yeah. Well, I'll tell you, John, it's been great having you on. We have just literally blown through the interview time here. And everybody, we're talking here with we just got done with John J. Miller here, talking with the First Assassin. You go to heymiller.com and available on Amazon. You can find the book, again, The First Assassin, 1861. It's about President Lincoln, Civil War, and a whole great fictional setting. So, John, I want to thank you so much for coming on. It was a pleasure.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
All right, and stay and keep us in touch with, you know, with your sequel, and you know, we'd love to have you back.
All righty, I hope it's not too long.
Oh yes, 5 years. Okay. All right, thanks a lot, John. Have a good one.
Thanks a lot. Bye bye.
Bye. So again, everybody, that was John J. Miller that we just had here, and The First Assassin. Go to heymiller.com to check out more on that book. A very fascinating and exciting read. We're now bringing one of our good friends back on the show here. We just had him on, I believe it was about 5 weeks ago, and Alan Jacobson, who, you know, is a fabulous author, has this book out called Velocity. We met him for the first time in face-to-face in BoucherCon. It's a Karen Vale novel. And, you know, he has Crush, The Seventh Victim. So, Alan, I know that you're on this great book tour, and it's great to have you back. So glad that, you know, you were able to get some sleep because you came from San Francisco all the way over to Washington. You're only there a couple of days, but how was it? And how are you doing again?
Doing well, but wait a minute. Who said I've gotten some sleep?
I'm hoping you got some sleep because, man, you were flying all over the place on this book tour, like you announced before, that this was the first one that you had to fund on your own.
Yeah, publishers are down on book tours, and I have to say that there's good reason for it. It's I can't say that it's really a good investment. A publisher could spend $20,000 on a book tour, and you have to sell an awful lot of books to just make back your investment. So I understand where they're coming from, and who knows? I don't know how many authors are going to still tour in the future.
Yeah, so how's it been for you? I mean, it's been kind of, you know, difficult, I guess, out there on the road?
Well, tours are always tough because you're rushing from one city to another. You've got interviews, you've got emails coming in from your publicist, you're exchanging information and reviews and all sorts of exciting things with your publisher. So it's a constant flow in and out of information and last-minute changes, and of course you have the events, usually at night, sometimes during the day. I had 3 events in one day last week. It was that when you said leaving BoucherCon to go to Washington, D.C., I was up for 46 hours at that point.
Jeez.
And, you know, you kind of start questioning, you know, your lucidity, you know, because you're not thinking. Your brain kind of runs out of gas, and you can't really think straight at that point. But I made it through that leg of the journey and moved on, and now I'm in Los Angeles, and it's been a very interesting tour for a number of reasons. Something very exciting that I want to share with your listeners is that my publisher has arranged for The Seventh Victim. So you mentioned that earlier. That's the first book in the FBI Profiler Karen Vale series, right?
Mm-hmm.
It came out 2 years ago, almost to the day. And it is now being offered for free on the Kindle and the Nook. So that's incredible.
Ooh.
And it's been for free for about the last 3 weeks. It has been number one on Amazon's bestseller list.
I saw that.
Yeah, did you see that?
I did.
Really awesome.
Well, I sent you an email congratulating But you didn't get back. I know that you've been busy. I saw it, yeah.
And Velocity has done exceptionally well as Crush. I mean, Crush has seen a second wind, so to speak, all because of ebooks. So Velocity was number 6 on Amazon's bestseller list. So it's all been very cool, very exciting stuff. I had a meeting with my agent this afternoon, and you know, we're talking about movie stuff. So there's a lot going on, and you know, you just got to keep your wits about yourself and work on writing the next book, which is what I'm doing also while all this is going on.
Right. And did they decide to put this up for free because they wanted to entice people to, that maybe are thinking about getting Velocity, and they're like, you know what, here, get The Seventh Victim just for free, then go ahead and get Crush one of those readers that have to read everything in order. You know, what made them decide to do that?
Well, the concept was basically introducing me to a host of readers who haven't read me before. And the thinking, the feeling is that if they read Seventh Victim, they are going to want to read Crush. And once they read Crush, they are going to want to read Velocity.
Right.
So that was the concept behind it. And it's exceeded beyond our wildest dreams the success for Seventh Victim, and that's also translated into success for Crush and Velocity. So it was a good move, and it's really been exceptional.
Now, when I'm sitting here looking, do you have a separate publisher that does your ebook? Did they buy your rights to do that? Because
no, ebooks.
Is Perseus under Vanguard? I guess.
Yeah, Perseus is the big publisher that has, I think, 10 imprints. Vanguard is one of the imprints.
I can't keep them straight, I tell you.
Yeah, they do mostly, Perseus does mostly nonfiction. Vanguard is its only imprint that does fiction.
Okay.
At least that was the model. I don't know if they varied a little bit here and there, but that's the model. And, ebooks, particularly now, are becoming a more and more important segment of bookselling. So,
right.
Most publishers, I don't know of any publisher that's going to want to give up ebook rights for somebody, for another publisher to publish them. So right now, I think you're going to find that whatever publisher is doing the hardcover and paper is also doing the ebook.
Right. But remember, we talked in BoucherCom about some stuff that you had in the past, did we not?
Yes. My first two novels, False
yeah.
Accusations and The Hunted, are both out of print, and boy, if there's ever a market for an out-of-print book, it's those two novels. So we're
looking
at...
You've got to check your email coming up this weekend, because I might just be sending you something, and you can look at it and see what you think.
Definitely send it to me.
Yeah.
Next week, I'm going to be playing catch-up, and that's not mustard ketchup. It's ketchup. It's ketchup. Trying to get my my wits about myself and really catch up on all the things that fell through the cracks, of which there are many, I'm sure. While you're on tour, you keep getting tons of emails on your phone, and it's just hard to keep up with all that. You prioritize, and if your publicist sent you a request, you have to immediately respond and get that out, and same with your publisher. So it's triage, basically. And then at some point you try to go back and catch up. But being on a tour is definitely a challenge. And that's the flip side of the coin, is that is this time that you spend, is a month where you're basically not being productive, meaning writing new material, creating this content, is being on the road the best use of your time? And that's the question, really, for most authors. And I don't know. There are a lot of intangibles involved, for sure. There are certainly advantages, but much fewer advantages than there used to be, the old days.
Well, you know what? I mean, for somebody who, because we've never done a tour, and a lot of authors – a lot of up-and-coming authors, always listen to the show. We get a lot of questions, and they ask us questions, and I'm like, I can't answer them. I don't know. Kind of walk them through, if you could, maybe like the first half of the tour of exactly, you said you're up for 46 hours, what you did, and, not only is it worth it, but, you know, I mean, just going through it. I mean, what can they expect if they decide to do this kind of an undertaking to get to the public?
Well, I mean,
go get your coffee.
Yeah, really. You definitely live on coffee and iced tea and Coke Zero and anything that has caffeine to try to keep you awake and your brain sharp.
Good old-fashioned jolt.
Yeah, well, and then, of course, you don't sleep when you do finally hit the bed. But,
exactly.
You know, it's intensive. If you have somebody setting up your tour for you, that's great, because that's certainly a big part of it. But then there's give and take, where you're working with your publicist in terms of your schedule. You know, how long do you want to be away from home at a time? And where, you know, and they try to also set up a schedule so that you're not going back and forth east to west, you know, across the country. You want to try to handle it regionally and intelligently. So you make your East Coast swing and then work your way back toward the West Coast, or vice versa, if you're lucky enough to have, you know, a national tour. What we're seeing more and more of are regional tours, where if you're from back east, you hit, you know, some eastern states, and if you're out west, you hit the western states, and that's pretty much it. I have gone, as we discussed, I went to Washington, D.C. I did Colorado because I was asked to go there. So, you know, you try to work it out so that you're not going back and forth. Setting up that schedule is extremely difficult, because you're dealing with I'm what's called an A-list national author by Barnes & Noble, for example. So we can't schedule directly with the stores. It has to go through corporate. So, and the reason why they do that is they try to spread the A-list authors so that they're not all going to the same cities or the same stores in those cities. So the theory is that by corporate controlling it, they distribute it and disperse you. So that makes it more difficult, just because it's not a simple phone call to a store. It's a phone call, you know, where my publicist has to speak with the events manager at corporate, who then coordinates it, speaks with the store, and then so on and so forth. So there's a lot of moving parts, and if for some reason a date is taken, that could throw off your whole schedule, and then you're almost going backwards. Okay, so now how can I – because there are also only certain days where the bookstores want to do signings.
Right.
So, you know, you have Tuesdays and Thursdays are big days. A Saturday is a big day. But the other days, not so much. And then certain independent stores have – schedules where they say, you know what, Tuesday or Thursday doesn't work for us. We prefer Fridays and Sundays. So all these little factors have to be compiled and determined what the best way to handle your schedule is in each city. So it's an enormous undertaking to set out a schedule that works, an itinerary that is intelligent and works for the author and for the stores. So that's, in a nutshell, kind of what's involved in setting it up. When you leave on tour, it's different now than it used to be, but they would have media escorts that would pick you up at the airport, take you to your hotel, take you around town wherever your signings or commitments or interviews were, and then take you back to the hotel, and you'd then, you know, head off to the next city the next morning. But you know, they're long, very, very long days. And if you have an interview, I did an interview in, I was in Seattle, this was a few years ago, and it snowed in Seattle, which is really kind of unusual.
Right.
But it snowed a lot, so that when I woke up at 4:30 in the morning, because I had to be in Portland for an NPR interview, so that was a pretty important interview. So I had to catch a plane. Well, I woke up at 4:30 and everything was blanketed in snow. And we couldn't get anything. There were no cabs, no cars, no rental cars. Nobody had even gone into work, certainly not that early. So it became a real difficulty.
Yeah.
And how do I get to the airport to make my interview in Portland? And finally, the concierge offered me, you know, he said, nothing's happening here. I'll drive you to the airport, which was so incredibly nice of him. And so he drove me to the airport. The plane was late taking off, but it did take off. I got to my interview 5 minutes before it started in Portland, and we did it. So that's one little story of bizarre things that happen on the road when you're least expecting it. Snow in Seattle, you know, it happens.
Exactly. And the one thing I just, you know, because I'm looking at your events, and just so you know, you forgot an E in suspense, so for your Friday night radio interview. So they have the website up there, and they forgot the E at the end of suspense, so it's taking them to the wrong page, but that's, you know. So, you know, that stuff happens too.
Sorry about that.
We need to get your editor. So, yeah, I mean, you know, it's a huge, huge undertaking, without a doubt. And I think that's the one thing, you know, I guess it's anything. If it's new, people are like, yeah, let's go on tour, and it's going to be so great, and it's going to be so wonderful. And you get there, and what if you get to a bookstore, and you're there for 2 hours, and 15 people show up? I mean, do you feel depleted? I mean, do you go in there with expectations saying, you know, if it's so many, that's great, but if it's less, you just kind of feel like, damn, I just wasted my money and time to come here, and I didn't get anything from it.
Well, you know, I've done so many book tours that I've learned that stuff's going to happen, and it does happen, and there's nothing you can do about it. You try to be a good sport about it and just keep your head up and move on and move forward. And there have been a number of things that have gone wrong on this tour. It's just inevitable, from, you know, a store not having the correct date to forgetting to order your backlist of books, or they ordered books and they didn't come in. I mean, you know, it's a long list. So you just do the best you can. You make the best of it, and you move on to the next city. There's just nothing that you can do, John, really.
Yeah,
is it
is
a waste?
It's,
yeah, it's a waste. You know, there's a lot of waste, and there's nothing you could do. But then you have certain signings where you have a lot of people come, and they're fans, and you've seen them year after year, and it's great visiting with them. Mm-hmm. And they're excited to have you sign their book, and I speak for 30 or 40 minutes, and I answer questions, and they really appreciate it. And I mean, you know, that's the kind of thing that you want to have happen. And those signings, those events are what make it worthwhile. So,
yeah,
you know, you do the best you can. And fortunately, in Velocity, we have a book that has really caught fire, and the reviews have been absolutely awesome. And it has made the top 10 list for the Strand magazine. It made another. Well, you know what? Hey, you know, you guys are different. You're different.
Yeah, I know.
But
that's good, though. I'm happy that, I mean, you know, that's great to be recognized in every sort of media. You need to have it.
Absolutely. And we had that great interview in Suspense magazine in November issue.
Yeah.
Awesome. Awesome issue. So anybody who hasn't picked it up, you know, definitely pick it up. You'll find some fantastic interviews in there with a lot of really, really good writers.
And where on the bestseller list did it hit?
Number 6.
A New York Times, okay.
No, Amazon's.
Oh, the Amazon bestseller. Okay.
Yep. And so we're very, very, very excited about this. And, you know, this book has legs, and people who've read it are excited about it and, you know, want to know when the next book is coming out. And, you know, I hear that a lot. I couldn't stop reading. I read it in a day, and now I have to wait another year for your next book.
You're like, well, you have to, or you could go back and read the other ones that are now free if you haven't read them, and get them, pick them up.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Well, these, you know, typically they have read all my books, and now, you know, so they've read 5 and waiting for 6. And, you know, you can't really write them fast enough, but you know, it's a process. You want it to be as good as it possibly can be. So it's not a race. You have to write it as it comes, and you want it to be the best it can be. So,
yeah, because you don't want to get hammered for it if you bring one out and you rush it out just because people wanted it, and then they hammer you and they say, what the hell were you thinking? And you're like, well, you asked for it in 6 months. This is what you get.
Right. No, yeah, exactly. That's just not an argument. And you have to know, look, I can't sacrifice my integrity. I have to do what I have to do to make it the best it can possibly be.
Right.
And, you know, if everything aligns properly, it shouldn't be a problem. And and you know, it's just a lot of work. You got to put the time in and the research. You know, for Velocity, I did more research with the FBI Behavioral Analysis Unit. I did a lot of research with the DEA because mm-hmm. there's a whole storyline involving illicit drugs, and it was fascinating to work with them. These people are tireless in their pursuit. I mean, they look at it as a crusade. Mm-hmm. The quote, war on drugs, they don't like that term because they look at it as a series of battles. Because really it is, if you look at it and step back, it's very intimidating for anybody because mm-hmm. these cartels are so powerful and so wealthy, nothing is beyond their reach because money can buy just about anything.
Yes,
so,
on Prop 19 for California. Yes, on Prop 19.
Yeah, if that were the answer,
stop the cartels from coming over here. Yes, on Prop
19. Yeah. Now you know what? I really don't see that having an impact on the cartels at all.
Maybe not in the U.S. in a whole, but I do believe that would do something for the state of California because. Like I was talking with Shannon in the car, and we were sitting there talking. I'm like, look, you know, when you look, I don't know if you got your little thing in the mail. California does a great job of sending you those books, and you get to read about everything. And we never got that when we were in Ohio. You kind of went by the seat of your pants and hoped you knew what you were going to do. But the only negative that they could come up with was they didn't want people smoking and driving because they're going to be stoned. And I'm like, okay, first of all, that's the same argument as far as alcohol goes, but people do it all the time, and hundreds of thousands of people die every year because of DUI. And if people, you know, if people ever got stoned, like myself, I have, I don't want to drive when I do that. I want to sit and eat Doritos and watch TV and not move. So I think that's a bogus argument, first of all. But for it is so much better because why would you risk yourself going to the corner dealer when you could go to 7-Eleven and get it maybe a little more expensive, but get it legally and not have to worry about any problems? So I do think that that's going to hurt the dealers, which I think will then in turn hurt the drugs coming into California, because what would be the point? And if they just do it legally, then they're able to sell it for legal, and then they can still make a ton of profit.
Well, you know, yes, maybe. The devil's in the details and the application. And I think that we have to be very, very careful. It may play out that way, but it may not. Because just like with other things that were illegal and made legal, you can have a black market or a gray market. And if you're taxing something, then there are always going to be people who are trying to get it without having to pay the tax or getting it for less money.
Sure.
And it's not some unusually processed product. You can grow it. Anybody can grow it. So when you have these drug cartels that are taking our national parks and turning them into marijuana grows, that's a problem. And that's not going away. Yeah, and that's not going away if it's legalized. It's just not going to happen.
But we're
eight years
removed from prohibition, and I don't think, and like I always say, I think that marijuana is a much less violent, dangerous drug than alcohol is. Without any doubt in my mind, alcohol is a lot more dangerous, and we let that legal. And if we regulate marijuana the same way that we regulate alcohol, then just remove the stigmata of the word marijuana, which people don't realize why it was created illegally in the first place. It wasn't because it was a drug. It was because the clothing manufacturers didn't want hemp to come in and take over their businesses. That's the only reason it was labeled illegal. Okay, it had nothing to do with the drug itself. So if they take away that stigmata of that, knowing that alcohol gets you screwed up and buzzed, and marijuana does the same thing, and it's a naturally grown plant that's in the wild that you can find or that you can plant and not be processed and smoke, then if as a Christian aspect, God put it here for a reason, use it for its fullest.
Well, then let me ask you, what about cocaine, legalizing cocaine?
Cocaine has to be processed.
Cocaine
is a processed drug that has to be manipulated and processed. And cocaine did have uses way back when because it used to be a painkiller.
Right.
And now they've manufactured it to where it's something else. But prescription drugs and prescription abuse are a lot more dangerous than marijuana abuse. And that's still going on, and prescription drugs are legal under the guidelines of being regulated. But everybody, whether it's alcohol or marijuana or cocaine or prescription drugs, everybody that wants to do something illegal is going to find a way in order to
sure.
do it. That's never going to stop. But
right.
if you make it legal, you remove the stigmata from people to say, oh, well, it's no cool now. Because before you were 21, and I was guilty of this too, you wanted to get drunk because it was something that was, you know, it was a thrill to do, to see if you could do it. Once I turned 21, I probably got drunk more before I was 21 than when I was after 21, because now I could get it whenever I wanted it, and it just wasn't fun anymore.
Right.
And
well,
so I think that it's the same thing, and I don't see a difference.
Well, one advantage I see is that we won't be clogging up the prison system with
exactly.
Offenders, yeah, that's absolutely a legitimate benefit.
61,000 arrests of marijuana and 60,000 violent unsolved crimes in California last year. Now that's ridiculous. And why are we putting marijuana people in jail and then letting the people who are supposed to be in jail out early because the jails are overcrowded? That just makes no sense to me.
I don't know what the problem is. FBI profiler Karen Vail solves all her cases. She clears
exactly.
them. So what's with all these unsolved
crimes? So, yeah. But, hey, you know, I had a question I wanted to ask you, but I'm going to email it to you off the air, because someone had asked me, how do you set up a blog tour? And they wanted to kind of know, you know, how to do it. So if I could email that to you and you could get back to me, that would be great, because it's a friend of mine who's, you know, wanting to find out maybe how that works.
Sure.
If you've done that, yeah. So I'll tell you. But, Alan, I mean, we could go on for days talking about marijuana and alcohol. But, yes, on Prop 19, because it's better than alcohol, and I just think it's a lot funner. And I don't even care if that's worth or not.
and yes, on Velocity.
Yes, on Velocity, and yes, on Seventh Victim. Yes, on Crush. Seventh Victim is free, everybody, with a Kindle. Okay, go to Amazon. It's freaking free. How can you put it this way? You pick it up, and you didn't lose anything. And then you're going to go, and you're going to get Crush, and you're going to get Velocity, because you've now discovered Alan Jacobson, and then he's going to bring you another book coming out here in another year, and False Accusations and The Hunted are going to hopefully be available soon, if we can get all the details worked out and you like everything. And we're going to go ahead and get those back, and you can get all five. All five of them right there, and spend your days reading them, because they are really fast reads, and you can literally plow through them, which is why Velocity is such a great title, because you read it at the speed of velocity.
That's actually true. That's what I've been told. There was a meaning there that I hadn't even thought of when I was conceiving of Velocity. One other thing I wanted to mention, John, on my website, which is alanjacobson.com, there is a free personal safety ebook that I co-wrote with FBI profiler Mark Safrick, one of the profilers I've worked with now for almost 18 years. And so just go to my website. You'll see the place. You enter in your email address, and the PDF document is sent to you. It's full of extremely important information on staying safe. We don't just go through the tips on personal safety and home safety and cyber safety, but we teach you the concepts, why these criminals do what they do, what they're looking for, how they choose their victims, so that you can apply those principles to any situation you find yourself in.
Right.
So it's free on my website. You can also go to safetybooklet.com. It'll take you there too.
Yeah, just scroll down. It's on the right-hand side, right underneath Velocity and Seventh Victim and Crush. It's right there in red. Well, Alan, we got like 60 seconds left. I want to thank you so much for coming on. It's been a blast. We're going to have to do it again, without a doubt. So,
just let me know when.
Thank you so much, Alan. Check for my email, and we're going to get together. So, everybody, alanjacobson.com. Go get Velocity. Stop running around and figuring out what to read, because it's sitting right there in front of you. And freaking Seventh Victim is free on Kindle. So everybody, again, Halloween special coming up Sunday. It's a great weekend. We'll see you Halloween. Nice and clear. We'll have some fun.